listening to The People's Show.
You come at the K, you best not miss.
Left circle, Besser, one time left shot, he scores. Brock Besser beats Jordan Binnington on the power play, and the Canucks are up 4-0.
With Seth, Dan, and Randeep.
The biggest thing to hit Canada because the Maple Leafs suck.
On the official home of the Canucks.
Goes all the way down the ice, here's Pettersson after it. He's got a chance at a breakaway. Pettersson in clean, is tripped by Murray, but he scores. Dinky Pete comes out of the box and puts the puck into the back of the net.
Sportsnet 650.
Welcome, citizens of the People's Show. We come to you live on Sportsnet 650 on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations. It's Dan Riccio and Randeep Janda, the People's Show, with you until 7 o'clock. Be a part of the show, 650-650 on the Dunbar Lumber text line. That is how you become a part of the conversation. The smart alternative, visit Dunbar Lumber on Bridge Street in Ladner or Arbutus in Vancouver, online at dunbarlumber.com. Busy show for you today. We'll start assessing the Canucks at their bye week, Randeep. Is that what we're calling this now?
We're calling it the bye week.
Yeah, it's the bye week. Okay. It's the moment in the season where the Canucks got a couple of days off, although it's not really a bye week because they're not off in Cabo doing whatever it is that Louis Erickson and the boys would be doing in Cabo.
Four practices in a week is not a bye week, but we're calling it a bye week. It's the closest thing to a bye week that will happen this year.
Boudreaux's got, like, the best mentality for this. It's like, oh, yeah, I'm super nice. We're practicing every day this week.
And we're focusing on conditioning.
But I'm going to be nice to you, sort of. And we'll crack some jokes and have some fun. And everything's good because we have points in nine straight games.
It's awesome because he plays the good cop and the bad cop at once.
He plays the good cop, but just like subtly plays bad cop in that we're practicing every day this
with
week.
A smile.
Yeah. And he curses as he tries to sit down. It's great.
Don't we all?
not while I'm on the air, but otherwise, yes, mostly. So we'll assess the Canucks at the bye week. The good, the bad, the ugly. A lot of it's been good lately, but honing in on specific players as well. Who has lived up to or exceeded expectations? Who hasn't? I know we all know that there's one specific name that has not lived up to expectation, but this team didn't have the awful start that it did because of one player, so who else is on that list? What else is on that list if it's an overarching take or feel on the organization beyond just a specific player that hasn't lived up to expectation or just hasn't delivered? So we'll get to all of that. You'll hear from Quinn Hughes. You'll hear from Bruce Boudreaux and their media availabilities today. Also, Mark Schofield will join us after 3:30. We've got David Pignota and Irfan Ghaffar joining us through the 4 and 5 o'clock hours and into the 6 o'clock hour, the final hour of the show. I know a lot of Canucks fans feeling some, I believe the German word is Schadenfreude towards the Edmonton Oilers.
Another good word you could apply to the Oilers is maybe some hubris heading into the season. It's kind of backfiring, no?
A little bit. Little bit. Oilers losing again last night, and maybe the panic buttons are being pushed. Connor McDavid into COVID protocol. They're going through a little bit of a dry stretch, you might say, in terms of results. And after a game tomorrow night, they'll be on a little bit of a break as well.
It's very nice of the Edmonton Oilers to have their own very own dry January in solidarity.
You're on fire today.
Let's make it a good show.
Yeah, it's the People's Show, Dan Riccio and Randeep Janda. So Jack Michaels is going to join us on the Oilers after 6 o'clock. Of course, you are a part of the show, so get in, 650-650 on the Dunbar Lumber text line. And we talk a lot about this team and how they've been performing lately. Talked yesterday about how our opinions are changing of this team after the piss poor start that they got themselves off to. The good, the bad, and the ugly, though. It's not necessarily the halfway mark, but we've got a whole week to discuss this team, so we're kind of assessing everything about it in this moment as they go through the stretch of the final 50 games or so and try to make that push towards the playoffs. I know it's snowing outside, so be careful while you're driving. This kind of came out of nowhere. But it's pretty heavy out there, so be careful. But the good is where we want to start. Because we like starting things on a positive note, especially while you're cursing at the idea of driving home in this stuff.
Yeah, don't let the nickname of Danny Danner fool you. Reach is a very positive dude. Start with the good.
I'm glass half full Danny today, we think. We'll see once we get to the bad and the ugly of the Vancouver Canucks. The good. What has been the good of the Vancouver Canucks so far this season?
You have to start with the obvious here. His name is Thatcher Demko. He is, as of right now, in my opinion, but I'm not the only one in Vancouver, and if you watch Canucks hockey outside of, you know, maybe east of the Rockies, and you stay up late and watch these games, I think most people across the league would at least have him in a top three or four spot when you're talking about Vezina candidacy. That has been the good. He has, in many games, been the answer for the Canucks, where maybe there's a period of the game where they do fall into a bit of a trap. That's all right. You got a, you know, solid as a rock goalie behind you to give you confidence. And even when they turn their play around, you're able to be more aggressive because you got that guy behind you. And I said this before the season started. I kind of saw the Canucks as the Winnipeg Jets from a couple years ago, in the sense that a firepower, you know, a real, you know, strong group of forwards with firepower and having a excellent, one of the best goalies, defense, not so great.
You mean the Jets when they lost Trouba, Byfuglien, and Myers all in the same offseason?
Exactly.
Their right side was just decimated.
It was not good. It was a bad situation, but they were a team that still powered through because of the Vezina level of goaltending that they got from Connor Hellebuyck. And they could put up points in their top six. It took a while for the Canucks to get there, but the good has been the fact that we're talking about Thatcher Demko, not next year or projecting a Vezina-caliber goalie. We're talking about that this year.
Yeah. It's amazing how Demko, in the space of the early part of this season, like, let's look back at it from when he signed the extension. You know, he was playing really well last year, so he earned that extension with this team, and it made sense to go down that road. 5x5, how good are you feeling about that? Might be the best goalie contract in the league from a long-term perspective, given you have this guy at this number for the next 4 years beyond this one, all through the prime years of his career.
That deserves a thank you, Jim.
It does deserve a thank you, Jim. Not Rutherford.
No, the
previous.
The OG.
The OG thank you, Jim. And the way he has ascended is incredibly impressive. And under a workload that is tops in the league, where he's playing more or as much as any other goaltender out there, and yet here he is with top three, top five, however you want to look at it, statistics. Maybe even best when you look at some deeper numbers beyond what we get publicly. And I don't know. It's not that I didn't think Demko would be there ever, but I don't know if I thought it would happen this quickly for Thatcher, especially with the team that is out in front of him, right? That's the big factor here beyond Vasilevsky and those guys. The team Demko has had in front of him. Look at the decor he's got right now working in front of him while he's got a 950 save percentage under Bruce Boudreau. It's not exactly a who's who of the National Hockey League.
No, and it's been, you know, degree of difficulty has been high on a lot of these saves, right?
Yeah.
You're seeing slot shots, and he's up there with John Gibson of seeing the most in the league. So you're seeing a lot of point-blank shots. But what has been impressive of Thatcher Demko's game is he's making it look easy. Don't get me wrong. He's had probably three or four goal, save of the year candidates already, early on especially. But more recently, he's just looked comfortable. And that tells you how well he's been playing, where his mindset, which is something we've been talking about a lot for the last 2 or 3 years, even when he was a prospect within the system, you're seeing that at play right now. You're seeing how confident and composed he can be and efficient. And that is something that's very important. You talk to goalie folks like Kevin Woodley. You talk to goalie coaches across the league, saying that efficiency, it goes a long way because you're preserving energy at the same time. Now, looking back at the offseason, I remember we had a conversation on this show about whether Thatcher Demko is a top 10 goalie in the NHL. And at that point, I was the optimist saying, of course he's top 10. I think he's there. How do we reassess that conversation now, right? The fact that we're talking Vezina, even like top 10, yeah, obviously seems like it's way, way, way too low.
Well, he's played like a top 5 goalie so far this year. Like, who else are you putting in the conversation?
You know what I really like about his game, though, Reach, is that he plays it efficient. But when we used to talk about the resiliency and not giving up on a play.
Yeah.
We used to bring that up a lot with Jacob Markstrom.
Mm-hmm.
Thatcher Demko's got the exact same thing, but he's also very efficient in the crease as well. That is a complete goalie, where he's able to do both.
I would add to the good part of this, you could just look at it overarching as a Canucks goaltending. Because even Yaroslav Halak has been pretty much lights out since coming over to Vancouver and has been really good in any start he's had. You know, outside of that first period against Columbus, it hasn't always looked the prettiest, especially when you're contrasting it to Thatcher Demko, but he gets the job done. And at the end of the day, that's all that matters when it comes to being a goalie.
Well, you know, goes well with that that point you make is a text here, 650-650 on the Dunbar Lumber text line, and a thank you, Ian Clark. Sure, absolutely. You know, I think we've heard it from a number of people that cover the goaltending position across the league. He's one of the best in the game, if not the best in the game. So, but I think there is an element of when you're talking about goalie effort and goalie play,
mm-hmm.
Ian Clark's reputation is one of the best in the league for a reason.
Yeah.
And it's not recent. He's been at that level for some time. Thatcher Demko taking the step up, not from being a potential top 10 goalie to being a potential top 4 goalie in the NHL, top 5 goalie. That's a huge, you know, we got to focus on the goalie here because that leap, it's been in tandem with an Ian Clark, but that's on Thatcher Demko. That's on him figuring out his game and taking that next step.
Well, Demko, again, looking at the contract and just how good it is, think of the offseason when we were all like, what, Cal Peterson's also getting $5 million a year? Like, what happened there? And that doesn't even kick in until next year. And, you know, not that Cal Peterson won't be a decent goaltender, but he's not Thatcher Demko.
Yep.
So think about the added value of that Demko contract you're already getting.
Well, let's look ahead. Jack Campbell is the talk of the day in Toronto because he's shown what he can do. His stats are great. Now, Thatcher Demko's price point, $5 million, five seasons. If you're Jack Campbell, you're asking for that because you're in the center of the universe. It's probably that bar that has been set. But Jack Campbell's probably going to make a fair bit more. Thatcher Demko's contract is going to look like value. Forget next couple of years. Starting this year and next year, it's looking like value for sure.
Campbell has been one of the better goalies in the league alongside Demko this year. Leafs pretty bad defensively by the numbers. A couple of texts coming in on this. Oilers goaltending sucks.
It's a fact.
It's a good assessment. It's quality. It's to the point. I like that. Mikko Koskinen, we all thought, maybe he's going to hold. No, he's not.
You know how bad
couple of months.
You know how bad Mikko Koskinen is right now?
Ooh.
Jason Dickinson might score on him.
Oh, wow.
That's how bad he is.
Jason Dickinson only scores on empty nets.
Yes. That's where his lack of deception works. He can stare right at the net, at the center of the net and score.
This text, top five would put him with Vasilevsky, Gibson, Shesterkin, and Saros. I don't know about John Gibson, man. Like, I know you're a big fan of his, Randy, but he's not that guy right now.
Okay, if you're looking at this year's stats.
Definitely not John Gibson.
See, that the way I look at that top five, when we're talking about Team USA in the Olympics, and Thatcher Demko and John Gibson, I get that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But top five goalies, like Connor Hellebuck to me, I know it's not his most sparkling season. He's always in my top five.
Yeah.
Like, you got to really play some bad hockey to get bumped out of the top five. If you're talking about just based on statistics this year, I still would put Connor Hellebuck. I know he's not having a comparable year to Thatcher Demko, but I'd still put him in my top five. The question I guess we need to ask is, if you were going to pick a goalie,
yeah,
would Connor Hellebuck be in your top five? I think he would for most people still.
I think Hellebuck is not having as good a season as he's had recently, but he's still having a damn good year.
For sure. So Vasilevsky, you know, Demko, I put Hellebuck in that conversation. Shesterkin, you can't criticize what he's done. Gibson's not in my top five this year.
No.
And Saros, yeah, he's almost there. He's on the cusp.
Right now, I would say from a, like, if you're ranking best goalies in the league as a mid-season type of Vezina Trophy candidate conversation, probably go on Vasilevsky, Markstrom, Demko.
Saros is, I think, if you're just looking at this year, I think Saros is in that conversation.
And Shesterkin?
Yeah.
Honorable mention to Jack Campbell. Frederik Andersen would be in the conversation too. So that's kind of the list right there. That's who Demko would be working against or working with for the rest of the year when fighting for the Vezina. Now, the list of wins, the list of goods, isn't all that long. But I think we do have to put Quinn Hughes in there, don't we? Especially under Bruce Boudreau, how good he's been, trusting him to penalty kill more lately. That's working, as the Canucks penalty kill has been the complete opposite of what they were prior to Boudreau showing up. And Scott Walker, of course, who's running the PK. I think we all looked at Quinn last year and wondered. You were on two sides of the spectrum with Quinn Hughes. He is a dynamic offensive defenseman that you live with the mistakes when they happen, but in the overall, you're going to come out on top because he's just that good. And there was the others that would say, nah, Quinn Hughes, yeah, he can put up points, but he'll never be able to defend. And that's what we saw last year.
And that person often said, on top of that, he's small.
Yeah.
Those were usually paired together.
He's Tyson Barrie. That's who Quinn Hughes is. And I, like, not to disrespect Tyson Barrie, who's had a really good career and has made a lot of money. Quinn Hughes has such a higher ceiling than Tyson Barrie. And we're seeing it this year because he's kept the offense and has developed his defensive game to a point where you're seeing again the Quinn Hughes that you can envision fighting for Norris trophies through the prime of his career.
You're starting to see that player. And I was always wary of the conversation of this is what he's going to be, only an offensive defenseman, because even early on in his career reach, let's go back to one of the first games he played. Not the first five, but the following season in his true rookie year. Remember that game against Edmonton where he gets beat by Leon Draisaitl? Draisaitl goes wide on him, turnstiles him.
Yep.
What happens the next period? Quinn Hughes comes back. Draisaitl tries the exact same thing, and he plays it well. He plays it perfectly. So Quinn Hughes has shown that, and we've seen this and we've heard this from him as soon as Bruce Boudreau took the job, to say, you know that box you're trying to put me in?
Yeah.
I'm not that player. I can be better. I want to continually improve. If you've had a chance to, and we've had the chance to chat with Quinn a few times, there's a confidence that you can pick up on this guy. He knows he can be better. He knows he can push the, you know, push himself and smash through ceilings. So this whole idea of this is all he's going to be in, I didn't believe it from 1 second because he has shown that from game to game, within games, he's able to make that change, let alone, you know, in a season.
I think there's a level of understanding from Quinn that if he's going to live up to this contract and then earn another massive deal at the end of it, he has to do more than just put up points. And I said it in the preseason when the holdout was going on and there were numbers being flying around of what Quinn Hughes is worth, what the contract is going to look like. Quinn Hughes has to be able to penalty kill in order to really actualize as a true top-end defenseman. And you and Sat disagreed a little bit, and I get it. It's fine.
Didn't think it was realistic at the time, but clearly that was a different situation.
There's a natural amount of risk
yep.
that you take by putting a player like Quinn on the penalty kill. But now you're seeing that, and I don't know if I want him penalty killing all the time, but I do want that element of his game where, you know, if you're going to be, you know, he idolized Duncan Keith, as he said many times early in his career when we would ask him that sort of a question. Duncan Keith played every situation of the game all the time. He was the go-to guy for the Chicago Blackhawks through the brunt of their dynasty. And that's what those true, true number one D-men are. Quinn Hughes actually talked about his defensive game and how he would like to develop it, how he worked towards developing it this past offseason when he spoke to media this afternoon.
I worked on a bunch of different things, backward skating, and, you know, I practiced against Jack and Kyle Connor and Kopp and, you know, Zegras and a bunch of really good players. So I think those guys made me better. And instead of, you know, when we do three-on-threes, you know, and just worrying about, you know, playing offense, I would just, you know, if we're doing three-on-three for 20 minutes, I would just defend for the whole 20 minutes and not even do anything offensively. And I just tried to focus on that and get better, you know, poke checking and pit-pocking sticks. And I think Schenner's been helpful this year in Hamannik, and we're playing good defense right now, and Demmer's playing lights out, so those things help as well. And then I think the majority of it is just a mindset and, you know, not wanting people to score on you and defending hard and not making it easy, and I think that's a big thing too.
So there's Quinn Hughes and an element of maturity as he discusses how he went about growing his defensive game in the offseason. And there's a confidence there, but a belief that he can do all of those things. But I think young players, the one thing they often have to get over when, you know, they know, especially players of his ilk or that ilk, we know we can put up points. We know we can do all of those things. Dynamic offensively. But if I'm truly going to get to that upper echelon level of talent, of being one of the best in the game, I have to do it at both ends of the rink. And it's a prerequisite for all of these guys. What's the knock on Connor McDavid every playoff? Well, he keeps getting scored on in his own end. You know, can't outscore his problems in the playoffs. And it's harsh, but it is a reality. Connor McDavid's defensive game is not great. Not in the way that is the player we often compare him to, Sidney Crosby. Right? Dominant both ways. What's made Patrice Bergeron an automatic Hall of Famer? Dominant at both ends of the rink. Jonathan Toews never was the greatest scorer in the league, but why was he an absolute lock for any Team Canada conversation or anything like that? Because he was so good at both ends of the rink. And I know I'm comparing centermen to a defenseman, but it applies the same because you needed to see more of this from Quinn, and there's an understanding there. If I'm good at this end, it's going to create more for me at the other end and help my team that way. So that's just a level of maturity that had to come to Quinn's game early in his career.
It's such a rarity to see an offensive defenseman that does kill penalties at a pretty significant level, though, right? Like, even going through the list of NHL defensemen that get around 2 minutes per game, you're not going to have the point-per-game guys there yet anyways. They're maybe slowly climbing, and Quinn Hughes, maybe that's a goal of his. But, you know, if you look back at it, the guy that's probably had the most balance reach from an offense meets defense and penalty kill, it's a Drew Doughty. And Quinn Hughes is a much, much, much better player offensively in terms of, you know, Drew Doughty in his prime was a a solid skater, an excellent skater. But when we talk about offensive skill and what the ceiling is for Quinn Hughes, it's much higher offensively for him. But if you add a little bit of defense to your game, which he is now, and he's better this year, he's killing penalties. You talked about that next payday. You add that to the skill set you have. It's a monster payday. It is an absolute monster of a payday, because what do we know about players that are good at both of those things? They're valued.
Yep.
Doughty's a classic example of that, where teams, when he signed that deal, there's like, oh, this guy's got offense, but he's just a solid all-around defenseman as well. But he's going to give you points. And that took him to the next level. And I think with Quinn Hughes, team success is important, and that's what you strive to. You want to make sure that you are the most complete defenseman. That's what we've been hearing from Quinn Hughes. You'll love to hear it, because that means he's just that much more responsible. There's a maturity. He's going to make everybody around him that much better as well. But there's a real, real, you know, incentive for him beyond that as well, because you start to hit another stratosphere of payday on that next one. And you just have to look at that Doughty contract to be like, all right, if a defenseman like that can get that much, and he's good defensively, and his point production is okay, what can an actually offensive juggernaut of a player, if they really figure out the defensive side of things, what are they worth? You're changing the game then.
Lots more to come. And to those on the Dunbar Lumber text line calling it house radio, I guess you would prefer I say Quinn Hughes is bad at hockey, which would be a flat-out lie. The good, the bad, and the ugly, well, the other parts of that are still to come later in the show. We'll hear more from Quinn Hughes coming up after the break. Also, Mark Schofield is going to join us, our QB analyst, as some pretty big-time performances and some pretty big games upcoming in the final week of the NFL season. Mark Schofield joins us next. Plus, well, we've got Wrong Answers Only coming your way at some point during the show as well. And it's just me and Randeep today. So you might see a little throwback to 245 on the old program. It is the People's Show on Sportsnet 650.
Now back to the People's Show with Seth, Dan, and Randeep on Sportsnet 650.
Sportsnet 650's The People's Show is presented by your local Grip Auto and Tire location. Winter tire service and expert advice are waiting for you at gripauto.ca. A couple of thoughts on Quinn Hughes before we get to Mark Schofield. Rob in Victoria, the knock on Erik Karlsson since Ottawa can't play defense. That was the knock on him in Ottawa.
Yeah.
Even though he won two Norris trophies.
No, he could play all the offense he wanted, because Mark Mathot was like, yeah, you go do you. I'm good back here.
Is Luke Shen Mark Mathot?
He's not as paid as well as Mark Mathot. Mark Mathot made like, when they traded for him, he was making like $5.3 million per season.
What kind of like Christmas card does Mark Mathot send to Erik Karlsson every year?
Probably a Rolex a year.
Thanks for all the money you made me, pal.
And yeah, and then he went to Dallas and played a little bit longer. Where he almost got his, was it in Ottawa, he almost got his pinky chopped off by Sidney Crosby.
That's right. Hughes is a $9 million player. Canucks have him at less than $9 million right now.
But
for the next 6 years.
My point was, if he starts to kill penalties more, if he's more of a defensive player, and had to look up these numbers, Adam Fox plays 2 minutes shorthanded every night.
Yeah, he's good.
Morgan Riley plays 153 every night. Also puts up points. Cale Makar, he's hovering around like 50 seconds per night. Quinn Hughes, still at that 20-second mark, but remember, the first 25 games of the year, he wasn't killing penalties shorthanded.
Yeah.
So, you know, with Travis Green, so let's see if that number goes up, if they get better on the penalty kill, if he gets better defensively. But you look across the league at his peers, yeah, they're all, some of them anyways, are doing it at a very high level, like Adam Fox.
Our next guest, a fine penalty killer in his day, also a better QB analyst. He joins us every week on the People's Show. What's up? It's Mark Schofield. How you doing, Mark?
I'm doing well, Dan and Randeep. Happy New Year, guys. And I was a very bad defenseman, a very awful penalty killer. Let's just put it that way. But it's great to be here with you guys, as I am each week.
It's great to have you, as always. A lot going on in the NFL, as there is every week. But the player that has, I guess, had my heart as a football fan for a lot of the year has been Joe Burrow. And the performance he and Ja'Marr Chase put on Sunday against the Kansas City Chiefs was just something else. It felt like it was from a different planet, and that's been going on all year long. That connection, I know it goes back to their LSU days, but it's just mesmerizing to watch when they're clicking.
It certainly is, and it's had me wondering in recent days if the decision by Cincinnati to draft Ja'Marr Chase is going to be something that's duplicated in the next couple of years. We know this is a copycat league, and a lot of people said, and I was among them, I said, look, you've got to make sure you protect Joe Burrow. You draft the offensive lineman in Penny Sewell or Rashawn Slater or whomever you want to draft. But they said, no, we're going to go in a different direction. We trust Riley Reiff, the right tackle we signed, and we want to pair Joe Burrow with a former teammate. And there's a reason for that. It's to tap into that relationship, because it takes time to build that trust between quarterback and receiver. So where, you know, like Joe Burrow basically said, look, hey, whatever, I know he's open, he's down there somewhere, so I'm going to throw it. And that's what he did in that 3rd and 27 to convert that long play late in the game. And, you know, that trust between the two of them is so critical to what they're doing, particularly on a lot of those back shoulder throws. And so you start spreading it forward. Well, do we see teams that have young quarterbacks try to draft former teammates? The Eagles sort of did that with Devonta Smith, you know, pairing him with Jalen Hurts. You've also sort of seen that with, you know, Jalen Waddle going to Miami with Tua Tagovailoa. You know, next year, maybe we see Washington, they drafted D'Amy Brown. Do they sort of do it in reverse and draft Sam Howell, the quarterback, knowing that that relationship is already built in? And so it's got me thinking, guys, the teams might sort of, from a roster construction standpoint, if they have sort of a younger quarterback, they might try to reunite him with a receiver he's familiar with. Maybe the New England Patriots, who might have a need at receiver, do they go a Jameson Williams from Alabama or a John Mechie from Alabama to try to pair him with Mac Jones? And so that trust between quarterback and receiver, that familiarity that, you know, look, I know how he's going to read this. He'll read it the same way I've seen it. He'll read it the same way we did it when we were back together in college. That can show up on plays like those back shoulder throws and in other critical moments. And so it's a critical part of what the Bengals are doing, and it makes me think more teams are going to try to tap into that.
Well, looking at last night's matchup with Pittsburgh taking out the Browns, our resident Browns fan is not here today, so I'm going to ask the question on his behalf. If you look at the confidence in Baker Mayfield, let's put the health aside for a second, or just move that aside for 1 second. The confidence, how worrying is that, and do you think he's the starting quarterback for Cleveland 2022?
I mean, I think he's still the starting quarterback sitting here right now. Mostly, guys, because I'm not so sure that there's a better option available. Now, certainly, if they could swing in for the fences and sign an Aaron Rodgers, or they can acquire a Russell Wilson via trade, if you go down sort of those roads, you know, yeah, there might be a better option out there. But, you know, looking at how the Browns have done things from a roster construction standpoint, I'm not sure they'll be able to entertain such a swing like that. It makes me feel that, you know, they're probably going to take a step back, look at, you know, the options available in the draft, and realize that there's probably not somebody that's a surefire week one starter. Now, the question ultimately for Baker might be, is he the week 10 starter? Is he the week 14 starter? Because it does seem like the relationship is a bit fractured. You read reports in the, you know, in the Cleveland media, and there are a lot of people that are saying that, you know, it looks like it's headed to sort of a divorce between Baker and the Browns. I just don't know if there's a viable option out there for him to start week one. Now, I think what's perhaps most concerning about Baker right now, you know, somebody brought to my attention that years ago I wrote a piece, Baker Mayfield and the Conundrum of Comfort and Chaos, because back when he was at Oklahoma, he seemed to constantly seek out chaos in the pocket, where he would never seem settled back there. He'd always want to kind of run around a little bit, escape the pocket a little bit, you know, try to make things happen in sort of scramble drill modes. And he never sort of grew into a pocket passer. There were flashes of it last year, but as we've seen him down the stretch be uncomfortable, and whether it's the injury or the offense or the weapons or whatever, he's just not comfortable back there. And it's impacted their play down the stretch. It, you know, it was one of the reasons that they're going to be on the outside looking in come playoff time. And so, you know, I think he's the week one starter sitting here right now because there's probably a lack of better options. But the bigger question might be, is he the week 5, 10, 12 starter in Cleveland next year? And that, I think, is a tougher question to answer, one that I'm not so sure has an answer of Baker Mayfield.
Ben Roethlisberger gets another dub over Cleveland at home. That's been the story of his career. What did he finish? 13-0, I guess. But looks like the end for Big Ben, as he hinted towards that last week. How are you going to remember Ben Roethlisberger as a quarterback?
I mean, in a way, what we saw the last 2 years is kind of a perfect summation of Roethlisberger, sort of, you know, the quarterback warrior. You know, a lot of people said last year that he was sort of, you know, he was washed up at that point last year. And, you know, there were certainly some discussions to that effect this year about, you know, the arm isn't what it used to be. He's missing easy throws. He's struggling. He's, and I talked about it earlier this year, he's afraid to throw 5-yard outs at this point. You know, but there's in some way, you know, sort of an odd beauty to that. An athlete, regardless of sport, sort of fighting against farther time down the stretch and, you know, fighting to go out on his terms rather than just sort of packing it up. And in a way, that's how Roethlisberger played the game when he was at his peak. You know, fighting in the pocket, shrugging off would-be sackers, you know, staying upright somehow when it looked like, you know, any other quarterback in the league, they're going to get dragged down for a sack. They're going to get dragged down for a big play for the defense. Instead, he's shrugging somebody off and throwing a laser 25, 30, 35 yards downfield for a huge gain. And you see, you know, those terrible towels waving in Pittsburgh. And so I think the past 2 years kind of sum up Roethlisberger, that warrior quarterback, that guy that just would not go down, the guy that would just, you know, stay upright, survive somehow in the pocket through brute will and strength and find a way to make plays for his team. And so, you know, it's sometimes heartbreaking to see a quarterback or an athlete, you know, who has played at such a high level have an end like this. But I kind of take a different view of it. I say, look, you know, they struggled so hard to get there. I admire the beauty in them going out on their own terms.
You're listening to The People Show. We're joined by Mark Schofield talking quarterbacks in the NFL. And I got to focus on the Dallas Cowboys. People around here call me the Cowboys hater because I've moved on from the Seahawks, Mark.
That's because you are the Cowboys. Yeah.
I just don't believe they've beaten anybody of substance. And yet again, they lose to the Cardinals. That offense, and, you know, having 5 balls batted away there, Dak Prescott not being able to produce on third down. What's behind this offensive slump? Because sometimes they look like world beaters. Other times, they don't look like they can move the ball up the field at all.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, when you're watching Dallas, you know, watching that game live and then sort of rewatching it, you know, this is an offense that at times has looked extremely explosive. And then, like we saw, you know, against Arizona on Sunday, they kind of struggled in some third down situations early in the game. You saw some passes, like you said, get batted down at the line of scrimmage. Amari Cooper and Dak seemed on a couple of different occasions to sort of not be on the same page. And so you're sort of wondering, you know, what's the issue with Dallas offense right now? And I think, you know, there's a couple of different things. I think conceptually, you know, I think Kellen Moore does a pretty good job, but I think there's some more stuff that he could be doing, you know, in the passing game from a play design and execution standpoint that I think would help. They've got some designs that certainly they can rely upon, and they do some very creative things in short yardage situations with an extra offensive lineman on the field, sometimes throw into that player, but dialing up some creative stuff on third and short, fourth and short, and things like that. I think they need to get the run game involved a little bit more. I think that would take some of the pressure off of Dak right now. You know, I think another thing that they'll have to consider in the next week or so is if this was indeed a playoff preview and if they do see Arizona again, there were a number of times when Arizona would get their sub-defensive packages onto the field with 6 linebackers, 5 defensive backs, no down linemen, show 7 or 8 up front, all of them in a 2-point stance. And Dak and the offensive in general sort of struggled in those moments. You know, that defensive look is tough that Vance Joseph has put together. He relied on it last year as well. And he got Russell Wilson, baited him with an interception in overtime last year, using that package because you're trying to sort out who's blitzing, who's dropping, who's coming from where, who's going to be dropping underneath routes. And on one play in particular, there was a sack on a third down situation where they only rushed 4, but they brought extra – they kept the tight end and the running back in protection. You only had 3 receivers downfield. Now you've got 7 people in coverage, and it led to a sack. And so thinking about it more in the immediate here, if they do end up seeing Arizona next week, They're going to have to figure that stuff out. It also points to another issue with Dak, which is sometimes this year, those sort of rotations post-snap where his expectations of the defense are one thing before the play, and it's something completely different after the play, and he has to sort of adjust on the fly. He's missed some opportunities in those moments. So that's going to be something I'll be watching this week and as they go into the playoffs.
Mark Schofield, our QB analyst, joins us every Tuesday on The People's Show. And I'm going to couch this with the Rams have had a pretty good season. But has Matthew Stafford worked out the way that they hoped he would?
I think, you know, if you're sort of going to put it on a scale of, say, 0 to 10, I think it's like a 6 or a 7. I still think he's an improvement over Jared Goff, but I don't think it's been the dynamite home run of a trade that people, myself included, thought it was going to be. I think they've had to, like earlier in the year when they were just going 5 wide, empty shotgun stuff and just letting them rip it, it looked great, but teams figured it out. And so what did they have to do? They had to go back to the offense that they're sort of running with Jared Goff. And yes, you know, Matthew Stafford runs that offense a little bit better. You know, he's a bit more aggressive of a passer. And so, you know, under Jared Goff, where he's running those three-level flood concepts off of play action and rolling out, he's throwing to the shallow route. He's throwing to the intermediate route. You know, Stafford's someone that's willing to hit that deeper stuff. And so it certainly opened up areas of the field that weren't really open to them in years prior. So there is that element to it. But that gunslinger mentality, it's a double-edged sword. And there are moments where, you know, he'll make throws, he'll make decisions that are a bit risky, and he seems to tend to do these guys when he's backed up in his own end zone or his own end of the field, and those lead to pick six opportunities. And, you know, you can get away with some of that stuff in the regular season. You can get away with some of that stuff playing a banged up and depleted Ravens secondary. But when you get into the postseason where every drive, every possession matters, and, you know, one turnover here or there can mean the, you know, entire course of the game changes, that could be a problem. And so I think it's been an upgrade, but I don't think it's been the upgrade to the extent people like myself, when we were writing about it when the trade went down, thought it was going to be.
Mark, I have a love-hate relationship with the Colts. I love what they do for the most part on defense and, of course, Jonathan Taylor, but I hate him because Carson Wentz, he doesn't really instill confidence. Can they get to the playoffs, and can they be a team of substance or a dangerous team in the playoffs if they get there with him as QB?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of in that boat with you where, you know, it's that similar sort of trust factor in a way that we would just kind of touch on with Matthew Stafford, where, you know, there are things that the Colts do that are very well. You know, the run game, obviously. I think some of the play-action stuff with Wentz sort of attacking downfield, that stuff works. But in terms of sustaining drives, in terms of putting together a drive where, you know, they're taking away their run stuff, they're also staying over the top of things downfield, and you've got to hit those sort of intermediate throws. You know, that's stuff where I'm not sure that you really trust him right now to put together sustained drives. If they're allowed to run the football at almost at will, like they've done at times this year, and hit on some things deeper downfield, they can be successful. But when you get to the playoffs, you're talking about, you know, the best teams, the best defenses, defenses with the ability to take away what you want to do and sort of force you to fight with one hand behind your back. If teams are going to be able to stop the run up front, but sort of stay up on the top of those vertical routes that they like to throw and force Wentz to sort of work underneath, attack underneath, to hit shallow routes and things like that, routes that are designed to get yardage after the catch, which he never felt comfortable throwing or never seemed comfortable throwing dating back to his days in Philly, then, yeah, they're going to struggle. So, I mean, you start looking ahead to some of the teams. Like, yes, they beat New England, but Wentz had a really bad game. I mean, it was 2 interceptions. It was a punt block for a touchdown, and it was, you know, a Jonathan Taylor 60-yard touchdown run that really told the story of that game. Wentz was a non-factor in that, and you see defenses like New England's or the Chiefs, for example, or their projected first-round opponent sitting here right now, Buffalo, they'll have the ability to take away what they want to do. Buffalo can certainly stop the run. They've done it against New England. And now can you see Carson Wentz making plays against that Bills defense if the game's on his arm? I'm not so sure I feel comfortable in that.
All right, Mark, every week we do the throw of the week. What is it?
It's Tom Brady. LeMay just keeps slinging it, and he had a throw to Gronk, one of those routes where you have to split the safeties, the two deep safeties. You get an underneath defender, linebacker, running with it. and it's just an absolute rope, and he puts it into a shoebox, as Gus Johnson likes to say, you know, 35 yards downfield into the only the spot where Gronkowski can make that catch. And he just remains playing that game, playing this game at such a high level. And to do it on an afternoon where you had that, you know, rather absurd scenario with Antonio Brown walking off the field mid-game, and to sort of stay in the moment and not let things like that phase him, it's so impressive to watch him week in and week out.
Okay, we got one more week left. What's the QB matchup of the week in Week 18?
Yeah, it's an interesting one because you go a couple of different ways. You could look at this game Saturday night between the Eagles and the Cowboys and say, is Jalen Hurts really the guy? He had a bad outing against Dallas earlier this year. Can he bounce back? Can he perform better? You know, will Dak Prescott and that offense come back? So that's a game I'm certainly keeping my eye on. But, you know, you look at Sunday night when you have, unless the Colts somehow lose to Jacksonville and these two teams get in with a tie, which would be an interesting scenario. Would they play for a tie in that environment, in that world? But you've got the Raiders versus the Chargers. You've got Derek Carr, who has somehow kept this team together, given everything that's happened off the field, put him in a position to potentially get in against Justin Herbert, who set a franchise record for touchdown passes last week. You know, anytime you're breaking records that were held by guys like Dan Fouts, you're doing something pretty well as a quarterback. And so I'm very excited to see that game. Unless, like I said, Indianapolis loses to Jacksonville and they decide, look, we're both in with a tie, so let's just kneel on it for 60 minutes and people will love watching that on television.
I thought you were going Vegas and the Chargers, man. Sunday Night Football for all the marbles? All the marbles?
Yeah, I mean, that's the one, right? Derek Carr, Justin Herbert, there you go. I mean, that's the one where, you know, those two guys have been playing really well. It's a win-and-get-in situation. So, yeah, that's going to be fun to watch for sure.
Always love it, Mark. Thanks so much for this today.
Thanks so much, guys. Have a great day.
You too. There is Mark Schofield, one of our favorites. Check him out on YouTube as well, doing great breakdowns of quarterbacks. Tom Brady's still getting it done, even at his advanced age.
I thought he was going to say he threw Antonio Brown out of the league with the throw of the week, but no, he actually went with a real throw.
He hasn't even been cut yet, which is very strange. Not officially, at least, even though Bruce Arians pretty much said, yeah, that guy ain't playing here anymore.
That's got to be like a cash thing, right? Like they're trying to maybe figure out how they can potentially save some money by seeing if they can have some sort of clause or see what
void him out.
Void him out or something. Exactly.
Or make sure nobody else signs him, as was the reports from earlier today that Antonio Brown would absolutely get another chance in the NFL. And I just had a total facepalm moment because why?
Okay,
why?
If you had to take a pick from any of the playoff teams, potential playoff teams.
None of them.
If the Raiders? No, that's not happening.
I would not that want. I just wouldn't want that guy on my team, man. You know, like they put players on do not draft lists. I do not want Antonio Brown on anywhere near my football team.
There is one team that probably would take a chance on him. Your Seahawks. If they were in it.
Mm.
If they were in it, your Seahawks would probably give it a shot.
That's another knock on Russ right there, that he wanted Antonio Brown so bad in Seattle.
You didn't see it. I love how you've just turned on Russell Wilson.
Well,
the last
he stinks.
Last 4 or 5 weeks.
Oh, yeah, sure. Put up 50 on the Lions.
Didn't say anything at the time when they were considering Antonio Brown, but now you're using it against Russell Wilson.
Yes.
Revisionist
yes,
history.
It is the People's Show. Dan Riccio and Randeep Jain. A big hour, too. Coming up on the program, back in on your Vancouver Canucks. David Pignota is going to join us. His take on the Canucks GM search and what else is to come as we get closer to trade season in the NHL. It's the People Show on Sportsnet 650.